Wake Up with Bill Finch is live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut. Speak your mind. 203-333-9422.
Welcome to Wake Up here on WICC. We had a little glitch there. The microphone wasn't turned on, and now it's turned on. And we want to wake up all of the concerned citizens in Connecticut by discussing issues of concern with people of influence. My thanks, as always, to Connoisseur Media. And special thanks to one of the Connoisseur Media's special supporters and advertisers, the men and women of the IBEW Local 488. I work with them closely on a day-to-day basis, and I have seen them working out in the cold throughout the pandemic. And just want to say thank you to all the brothers and sisters who are out there in the building trades, especially IBEW. Thanks for listening. And we're broadcasting, just so you know, from the bird flu free studios here in Milford, Connecticut. There's no bird flu here. Today we want to talk about immigration. Obviously, ICE has now started rounding up people who may or may not be American citizens. Evidently, some of them are American citizens. It's not a foolproof system. We have a law in Connecticut called the Trust Act, which my guest, Chris Rosario, state representative from Bridgeport, is going to explain and talk about his efforts to keep us safe here in Connecticut. Obviously, everybody wants a deliberate process to apply for asylum in the United States. Everybody wants our borders to be controlled. The political system has failed us for decades, with Republicans and Democrats never being able to come to any kind of a national unity on the issue of immigration. Sad, that's just the way it is these days, ladies and gentlemen. We know that our country is polarized, our parties are polarized, and we can't solve problems the way we used to be able to solve them. Unfortunate. But maybe through shows like Wake Up here on WICC and leaders like Chris Rosario, we might be able to help nudge the federal government. They say the states are the great experimenter for the national government. It's the laboratory of public policy. So I'd like to welcome my guest, Chris Rosario, a dear friend, great colleague, and a tireless worker for the underprivileged people that he represents, as well as those who are well off. But Chris has a special place in his heart for all of those who come from other lands, who work hard to get ahead. And Chris himself, his family is from Puerto Rico. They've had some of the similar challenges that people from other nations have had. And I'd just like to welcome one of my heroes in local government, Chris Rosario. Good morning, Chris.
Thank you, Mayor. Top of the morning to you. Thanks for having me on the program.
You know you get to my Irishness when you use top of the morning to you, so thank you. But Chris,
we're talking about immigration and international issues.
So we want to remember that immigrants come in all sizes, shapes, colors, and religions. And one of the raids was done by ICE in Boston, where many of the so-called illegals are from Ireland. You know, we forget sometimes, as has been recalled by sort of those on the more democratic side, that many of these immigrants are paying taxes, working hard, raising their children. And I think before we get into what you're doing, I just want to just bemoan the fact that the current resident of the White House has saw fit to challenge the Constitution of our country and challenge birthright citizenship. Chris, give me your opinions on that.
Well, you know, I think right now our country, as you mentioned before, the system on immigration is broken. It's been broken for generations. And right now we need leaders who prioritize solutions over spectacle. What you're seeing right now is pure spectacle. I think it's time to focus on strengthening the economy, addressing housing insecurity, improving our infrastructure, and not pushing unconstitutional policies.
Solutions over spectacle. Chris, I'm going to steal that as the motto of this show. Is that okay?
Absolutely. You're more than welcome to take that.
You know, those of us who've been in politics know that anyone can be a demagogue if they go into politics for the wrong reason. Anyone can split us apart. That's the easy part. Bringing people together, as you've done for your whole career, Chris, is more difficult, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, nowadays, especially what you're seeing coming out of, the White House today, policies are they're designed to divide us and distract us from the real issues. Our focus should be on uniting communities, not showing fear and discord, which is what's happening right now out in our communities, especially in black and brown communities. Let's not forget, this is clearly an attack on, you know, the Haitian community, the Puerto Rican community. It's my understanding in New Jersey, they did a raid at a warehouse and they rounded up 35 people and ICE detained 35 Puerto Ricans who are United States citizens. You know, I think right now what we're seeing is just shock and awe to satisfy, you know, the president satisfying his base. And he's made promises and he's trying to keep them. Unfortunately, you know, some communities are they're the dolphin caught in the tuna net. So that's what we have to live with right now.
And we've been able to save the dolphins. Now we have to save the humans. We're going to be back after this brief break and hear from Chris Rosario more about immigration and the great leaders like Chris Rosario and Matt Blumenthal who are leading us civilly toward a future here in Connecticut and welcoming immigrants who are here legally. We'll take a break and be right back.
It's time to wake up with Bill Finch, 203-333-9422. Only on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
Thank you for tuning in this morning. We're joined by State Representative Christopher Rosario, a longtime fighter for those in Bridgeport who need a fighter, and they have a great fighter in him, for sure. I want to just remind the listeners here that this is the voice of Connecticut. What is Connecticut? Connecticut is one of 50 states. Each state is sovereign, and there's a balance between the state's ability to govern itself and the federal government. The federal government, through our Constitution, trumps what a, no pun intended, what a state can do. But a state within those limits has sovereignty. And we often forget that because when ICE comes into a community, and I mentioned Matt Blumenthal in the last segment, Matt has a great video, I'm sure you've seen it, Chris, where he talks about the Trust Act. And the Trust Act basically says if ICE and the federal government want to come in and arrest our citizens, they have to have a warrant or they have to show how they're on the terrorist watch list or something like that before they can come in and arrest people. And we want to be remembering our viewers that last year, in the last several years, ICE has detained people, as Chris just pointed out, Representative Rosario pointed out that in a warehouse in Newark, there were many Puerto Rican citizens who, as we all know, are American citizens. They live in a territory. They don't have full citizenship rights of voting, which is unfortunate. We hope to change that someday because they don't have representation in Congress. Maybe that's why they're victimized more often, because they don't have that power of the vote. But in any case, we have sovereignty. And Chris, tell us about the Trust Act and what you want to do to amend it.
The Trust Act basically is a state law that protects those that are of, you know, undocumented status here. I don't like to use the word illegal, undocumented status who are here.
Because
living,
let's
working,
just stop there. They may be applying for asylum, correct?
They may be applying. Yeah, they may be applying. They may be in the process. They may be DACA. They may be there are different other types of, they call it paroles and ways to become naturalized citizens. So the Trust Act is basically Connecticut's law as a safety net. And I do want to thank Representative Blumenthal, Representative Stashstrom, the Chair of the Judiciary, and our Attorney General, William Tong, who have been great champions of that community and helped draft that legislation. It's been great. It's been great to protect those citizens, especially with those that are in fear. Some of our colleagues on the other side of the aisle here in Connecticut have some, you know, they want to get rid of it altogether. And as we mentioned earlier in past conversations, Bill, you know, us as a Democratic Party, we're not all a monolith. Some of us in our caucus do believe there need to be some changes in the Trust Act. And I know there have been having some conversations. I think the difference between the right side of the aisle, the left side of the aisle, the right side of the aisle wants people deported upon arrest. I believe in, you know, due process. And we're
explain to some of our listeners what that may mean, Chris. We have rules, we have laws. And due process is often just said, but tell us what that looks like to your constituents who make it detained. What they have rights, correct?
Yes, they have rights. So let's say you're undocumented and you are arrested and now you're going in the court system. And let's say, for an example, you had a Class B felony. So if you had a Class B felony or a Class A felony, and you went to say Cheshire. and you did 3 years in Connecticut
Cheshire
Federal
Corrections.
Prison. Yeah, Cheshire Corrections. You did your time in jail, and you had an ICE detainer. Under the Truss Act, under a Class A or B felony, when ICE comes to say, hey, you know, that inmate, that incarcerated individual has a detainer, then the state of Connecticut will say, all right, you can pick them up if you have a warrant, a signed warrant from a judge. There's some due process. So there's a due process. So that means they no different than if somebody you hear people international cases where an American citizen went to Italy and committed a crime. They did the time in Italian prison. No different than it would be here or anywhere else. So under the Truss Act, there's certain things that I know there's been some conversations to make some changes. There have been some C felonies and some D felonies, especially when it comes to domestic violence or sexual assault, that there may be some tweaking. But right now, there's due process. So if someone was arrested and convicted and they were in Connecticut correctional institution, they would do that time in Connecticut correctional institution. But if they had a Class A or B felony, they would then be turned over to the authorities, the federal authorities.
So I know you're a big supporter, as am I, of the Center for Family Justice, led by Deb Greenwood and her great staff down there. They're suffering now from cutbacks, but they're struggling mightily against the tsunami of domestic violence and sexual assault. Chris, tell us what you think. Can you reach across the aisle to the Republicans who advocate arrest, deportation upon arrest without due process? And can you offer an olive branch regarding the C and D felonies?
Well, you know, I think that's the difference between our chamber and I speak bicamerally for both the House and the Senate here in Connecticut. We're not like Washington. We're not going to get bogged down. Their leaders, Vinnie Candelara, Senator Harding upstairs, and their rankings and their folks, they're great representatives. They and senators, they love the state of Connecticut. We have disagreements, but at the end of the day, we find a compromise. And I'm confident that working together, we'll be able to find some compromise that, enhances public safety, which is first and foremost and paramount, is the public safety of the citizens of the state of Connecticut from Bridgeport to Basra. We want to make sure that our citizens are safe, but also that, you know, we do it in the right way. So I'm confident that we'll be able to do that.
And so do you have a bill? Are you proposing a bill?
Yes, there's a couple bills out there. I know I recently had a conversation with Steve Sastrom, who's the chair of the Judiciary Committee, on ways and alternatives to kind of address the public safety issues, because my constituents have reached out to me as well, and they're concerned about some of the public safety issues, especially with some of those Class C and D felonies. As you mentioned before, Deb Greenwood and the Center for Family Justice, many of those offenders do get released back into population because they have C and D felonies. So that's an area we definitely have to look out, especially certain types of offenses. We don't want to send somebody, you know, deport them for stealing a pack of gum.
So many times the right wing of this country paints the Democrats as snowflakes and liberals and soft on crime. I know from working with you over the years, Chris, and you know about me, we were pretty tough on crime when I was mayor and you were state representative, as the current administration is pretty tough on crime as well. You have no constitutional rights at the point of a gun, or when somebody hijacks your car, or when somebody is assaulting a child through sex or mental abuse. You know, your constitutional rights are going out the window. So as far as I'm concerned, so long as there's due process, so long as people have legal representation, so long as the laws are not stacked against one group or another, we want the laws enforced in a tough manner. We don't want it to be loosey-goosey where, you know, people doing harm to others are let go. That's the last thing in the world the Democrats I know want. So tell me what your philosophy is on law and order, Chris.
Well, listen, you know, you and I know I built a career on and you've been a leader in this on prison reentry and criminal justice reform. And we deal with folks at the beginning of the law enforcement system all the way to the end when they get released from incarceration. And those that have done their time and have been rehabilitated, I believe they do need a second chance and another opportunity to move forward with their lives. But at the same time, those that are at the beginning of the law, as you know, you're a parent, you have children that attend, you know, colleges and schools here in the state of Connecticut. So do I. We want to make sure that they're safe. And living in a city like Bridgeport, you know, we have a lot of urban issues and urban crime, which is no different than many other cities in the state of Connecticut or in the country. But we definitely want to make sure that, you know, those that are, you know, violating those rules and laws, that, you know, they get dealt with accordingly.
Well, I want to thank you also for your open-mindedness. I think maybe perhaps with both of us having so much time at the kitchen tables of places like Bridgeport, Stratford and parts of Trumbull and Monroe, where people are trying to struggle to pay their bills. The issue of affordability always comes up. The issue of tolerance toward the LGBTQI plus community always comes up. And I want to thank you for your efforts. Oftentimes, again, Democrats get pigeonholed as not being concerned. We have worked tirelessly to reduce electric rates, to reduce the cost of government by cutting back on expenditures on the public side. Tell me what your theory is about what government should be doing, what it shouldn't be doing.
Well, you know, as you know, we're big thinkers, and you and I spent many countless hours talking about big ideas. I think at the end of the day, as you mentioned, those we need to get back to that kitchen table. We need to get back to the dining, the diners. We need to get back to your lunch pail conversations. At the end of the day, as you mentioned, it doesn't matter who you love, who you pray to, people are people.
Yep.
And they're trying to live their lives. And they're going to get the same shock at that electric bill, at your mortgage, at your gas pump, no matter what race, creed, or color you're from. So I think that's what we need to get down to. We need to start working on those issues to make sure that we have a better quality of life, that we can afford to live here, make sure that rents are stabilized, that you can be able to purchase a home, to go to a good school system and raise your family. Those are the things that we need to drill down on.
It's funny.
As legislators.
Knowing a little bit about each other's families, I know that you as a dad have been confronted with many of the same issues that I've been confronted with regarding our families. And, I'm on the board of liberation programs, and I often say that there's only two kinds of people, those people who have drugs and alcohol problems in their families and those who are lying. And I like to think that in terms of gender and LGBTQIA plus issues, there's only two kinds of people, those that who have dealt with that issue in their family and those that are trying to cover it up. My struggle in politics has always been to reach out to the other side of the aisle to people who have had those same struggles, who don't think that they're above everyone else, who put their pants on one leg at a time and try to find solutions across the aisle. I know you're good at that. I've seen you run. If anybody wants to see a great show, he's almost like an auctioneer. When Chris Rosario has the gavel in the House of Representatives, I have never seen the House of Representatives, with all due respect to Matt Ritter and Jason Rojas, I've never seen it run as quickly and efficiently as when Chris has the gavel. Maybe they're afraid you're going to knock him on the head with the gavel. I don't know, but you do a great job.
Oh, I really appreciate that. I do have to give kudos to Joe Arizmendi, the former speaker, when he first appointed me as a deputy speaker. And I asked him, what do I do? I don't know how to do this. And he says, A, talk to Bob Godfrey.
Bob Godfrey from Danbury, a state rep, the longest serving. He and Mayor Mashinsky, the longest serving. I've got to interrupt you. We've got to take a break at the bottom of the hour for news. We'll be right back with Chris Rosario on The Voice of Connecticut, WICC.
Join the conversation, 203-333-9422. Back to Wake Up with Bill Finch, live on WICC 600 and 95.9, The Voice of Connecticut.
Well, welcome back with my titillating conversation with State Representative Christopher Rosario. Chris, how many dreamers are there in Connecticut? People that have been born to parents who are undocumented, and by their birth here, they are American citizens.
Hey, Bill, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I do know that even though we don't have the number off the top of my head, we all know people and interacted with people who are dreamers and have been instrumental in a lot of change and a lot of positive things that are happening in our communities, especially at the Capitol and throughout the state of Connecticut.
We talked about law and order. One of the things I always remind people is that In a city like Bridgeport, where you have a lot of people who are undocumented, if you want law and order, which you and I are pledged to, we had strong classes of police hired, and we diversified the police force so that the community would feel safe working with the police department. And we urge them always to communicate with the police department and help them solve crimes. If you chill that by saying we may throw you out of the country, why would anybody who is not documented cooperate with the police? They might get deported.
It's dangerous on two ends. One, for public safety, not only for the public at large, but for the undocumented community themselves. One of the reasons when you were mayor, we made great strides to reach out to the undocumented population to make sure that there were opportunities for them to feel safe, to cooperate with police interaction. Now we could fall back into a time where they were walking ATMs. People were just sticking them up and robbing them on the street because they knew that they were going to the banks, just carrying around cash, taking advantage of the day laborers. They'll put in a hard day's work and contractors would not pay them because they knew they had no place to go to and to report them. So it's really dangerous all the way around, all the way up to the public safety and the domestic violence incidents that we mentioned earlier in the show. It really is it can be a ticking time bomb.
You know, Chris, I work with the building trades, as I previously mentioned in this show and other shows. I'm holding a list of the 30-some-odd unionized contractors who belong to the National Electrical Contractors Association. These are the folks who play by the rules. The ones that come into the city of Bridgeport and go to a corner where undocumenteds are waiting to go do drywall or plumbing or electrical or whatever, with or without licenses, and they work for 3 weeks. They get paid cash at the end of each week, and on that fourth week, they just don't get paid. So they're working 4 weeks, getting paid for two or three. This is how they're exploited. And in many other ways. Chris, we're going to move on to a different subject now. You and I both are parents of Bridgeport Public School students. We believe in public education. During my two terms in office as mayor, the state came in at our invitation and took over the school board, created a new school board, and professionalized the office of superintendent. And within several months, a budget that could not be balanced was balanced. Every child above fifth grade got a Chromebook. Everybody got new textbooks, and the teachers got a raise. That was with an appointed school board. And we know in Connecticut, education's unfair. If you live in certain zip codes, if you have pigment in your skin, you're probably going to get a less than adequate education. If you're white and you live in the suburbs, you're probably going to get a much better education. That's just how the way Connecticut operates. We're trying very hard to change that. It seems to me that local control of education is not a requirement for quality in the urban areas, the Alliance districts. I would say, in my opinion, those should be state-run school districts because we've seen the difference. Right in our hand, we saw a great-run system with upward projection of test scores and then, ever since, a decline. So we've had it taken over. We love our city. We love our voters. We love our citizens. But I don't see that local control of school boards works in impoverished areas. I'd like to see the state on the hook, then they'll have to really fund equal education. What do you think?
Well, you know, I know times have changed since the last time, you know, you were in office, and my views have changed a little bit. I do believe that there should be some sort of hybrid approach. I do believe the state should be on the hook and financially responsible. You know, it's easy to cast blame on elected boards, but when you're not getting the resources, right. it's really, really difficult. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you had an elected board of people that all went to Harvard, Princeton, and Yale.
Right.
But if you're only getting, you know, 10 cents on the dollar, it's hard to make things work. But I do believe that I agree with the state intervention. We definitely need the governor and other leaders at the state to support Bridgeport in this difficult time. We're at a crossroads. This is the state's most populated city. If you leave another generation of children to fall behind, it's a shame on us.
Unfortunately, Chris, how many generations did we lose while we've been saying that? We've been saying that for 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. How are we going to fill your jobs at the IBEW? How are we going to fill all these manufacturing jobs
that
are coming down the pike? You're talking about now, we're talking about AI and quantum computing and all these other technologies of the future. And these kids won't even be able to sniff a job at those professions unless we do something. We do something now. I believe we're beginning. I'm hopeful. I'm cautiously optimistic that this is the beginning of the turnaround. And as you know, as a parent, my daughter now attends a Connecticut Technical School. Same goes for those kids that jumped off to technical school. I'm thankful that my daughter was able to receive a great education in the Bridgeport Public Schools and caught on very well, and very quickly to the high school. But there are some kids that unfortunately were not able to. So
I think the frustrating thing for people like you and me who are in public policy positions, we're accountable, and we send our children to failing schools, and we do it with the hope that we're going to be able to contribute and make them better, and not to avoid our responsibility of diversity, our responsibility toward our urban citizens. But when we hold accountable, or don't, a local board of education, which has got about a 10% turnout, about 10% of the voters vote for the school boards. So 90% of the people aren't even voting for school boards. They're never elected all at once. They're elected five one time, four the next. Usually you can't throw the bums out if they've had low test scores. It seems to me, and we propose this, that the mayor should be held responsible at the very minimum. But the best way would be to hold the state responsible. Put the state in charge of all the alliance districts. Then if they're underfunded, there's some place to go for the money. Where do mayors go when there's not enough money to turn the schools around? They go to taxpayers who are already paying the highest taxes in the state. To me, it's a failing system that's designed to fail. And every time, Chris, you and I have been parties to lawsuits. The first one was Horton versus Meskill. You served with Barnaby Horton, or just nearly missed him. He's now a 40-something, 50-something-year-old lawyer who's, as a 10-year-old, his father sued the state for equality. Horton versus Meskill, Johnson versus Rowland, CJF versus Rell. I'm missing one in there. Chef versus O'Neill. Every time we go, even our Democratic attorney generals defend the status quo, which basically is, if you are living in a poor zip code and you happen to be a member of the BOPIC community, you got to go to a failing school. That's our law. I just don't understand how we can tolerate that anymore. But hopefully, right, Chris, with the new leadership, what do you think will happen?
Time will tell. Time will tell. I'm cautiously optimistic, but very hopeful. I do say that the new acting superintendent, Dr. Royce Avery, has been, very open, transparent. Him, his entire staff.
That's good news.
The new book. Yeah, so the new board chair, she's met with the delegation. So hopefully we're sitting here from the same sheet of music. And I know the governor just recently visited Bridgeport. And, I know the governor. I know his heart. And I know that he's going to do everything in his power to make sure that these kids don't fail.
Well, I'm glad he took the bold step. And I want to thank you, Representative Rosario. We're going to take a break. When we come back from this break, I want to thank Chris Rosario for all the words of wisdom and helping our citizens understand what's going on here on Wake Up every Sunday morning. We have a standard fare every other week. Vic from the Orange Banned Book Club gets on and talks about a banned book. We're going to be talking about The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, which is a terrific book. Everyone should try to read it if they want to understand what Native Americans are up against. But we're going to return after a brief message from our sponsors and talk about that book and why it shouldn't be banned.
Talking about what matters to you this morning. Wake Up with Bill Finch. WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
Welcome back to Wake Up, where every other week we're joined by Vicky from the town of Orange, where she and other people read banned books. As you may be aware, Moms for Liberty, I think that's a misnomer because they're not for liberty, they're for control, gets on and bans books. And just to intro this subject matter a little bit more in a timely manner, if you've followed Senator Bob Duff, he's got legislation that he and Senator C.C. Maher have put in that would prevent schools from banning books, you know, sort of unilaterally, and give a guideline and a criteria for how book banning efforts should be handled. I want to thank Bob Duff and C.C. Maher for doing this. This is why you and I, Vic, are on every other Sunday talking about a book that's been banned and how ridiculous some of these bans are. Keeping in mind that parents and teachers need to make sure that children are reading books that have controversial topics at an age-appropriate time in their life. Some children can't handle things. The discussion in Norwalk, as I understand it, was about a book that used the splitting of immigrant families up to teach children about anxiety in the fourth grade curricula. Now, I think there's a legitimate argument. Are the children in fourth grade able to handle that subject matter? Maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but that's a local decision. We don't ban the book. We talk about when it's appropriate for children to be able to handle something. A National Book Award winner, Sherman Alexis, is the author of the book we're talking about, The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Sherman Alexis grew up as a member of the Coeur d'Alene tribe near Spokane. They are a long-standing tribe, thousands of years of history, worshiping the natural environment and trying to get others to do so as well. He grew up, and take it from there, Vic. It was about his personal memoir, having to go to an all-white school, and take it from there.
Yeah, so I think it was inspired by his personal experiences, right? He was a member of this tribe in Washington, yes, and this kind of talks about how he was, well, the main character in the book. I won't say that it was necessarily Sherman Alexis because it's inspired by, not his fully true story, but the main character in this book was born with what they call water on the brain. I'm not going to use medical terms, right? But
hydroencephalitis.
You know, yes, thank you. I would mispronounce. But he survived a surgery to save his life, essentially, when he was an infant, which was unexpected, especially given the challenges of getting medical care on reservation. But he had a ton of issues as a result of this, which then growing up led to a lot of bullying on the reservation. And, you know, for anybody who keeps up with Indigenous politics and Indigenous situations, both in the U.S., in Canada, and elsewhere, there's an extremely high rate of domestic violence in these communities, a very high rate of murder in these communities and missing people in these communities that goes unaddressed. So just to highlight a little bit the complexity and the challenges that they face, I think is important in and of itself. So I'm a big proponent of reading books written by and about Indigenous communities, as long as they are staying true to the community and not, you know, doing anything negative. In terms of this book, though, it follows him through his adolescence into high school, and it showcases a lot of the challenges in the community with alcoholism. We experience, while reading this book, like I said, bullying from his own community, bullying when he does move into a white school. I use air quotes, which you can't see because you're on the radio, but bullying when he moved into a white school.
We should have a sound effect for air quotes.
Right? Yeah. We really should.
Zing, zing.
The experience of his first relationship, it, you know, kind of runs the gamut. The sport experience, and then his conflict between which community he's going to kind of tie himself more to. It's a very good book from an objective perspective.
And yet the Moms for Liberty and other right-wing fanatical groups have decided to stop us from reading this book. Tell us a little bit why they might be wanting to stop us from reading this book. Have we lost you? While we wait for Vic to come back, we'll talk a little bit about the tribe that he belonged to. It's located in or near Spokane, Washington. Their territory was reduced by the white settlers over ages Spanish, French, and American European from 5 million acres to about 340,000 acres. It sounds like a lot, but when you consider their lifestyle has changed dramatically and the trauma that was created to the group over time has created many social obstacles. We're back with Vic. One of her kids probably yanked on the phone or something. Vic, you there?
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. I seem to have lost service for a minute. Sometimes that happens over here in farmland. So I think what I was saying was that we follow the main character's journey through adolescence and growing up, his first relationship, bullying experiences, his conflict between which of these communities he wants to kind of tie himself more to and really understand more. Not for spoilers or anything like that, he winds up losing his sister tragically due to an alcohol-related incident. We see a lot of alcoholism throughout the book. But this book was actually challenged in Connecticut, where we try and think of our state mostly as progressive. I try to think of it that way, at least. It was challenged last October in New Canaan. Some parents were speaking up at the school district board meeting, basically saying there was a child of theirs who had concerns because there were conversations in here using racial slurs. There were conversations in here that discussed masturbation, and they were uncomfortable. Here's the thing. You ask me every week, age appropriate, for my own opinions, what I think is appropriate. Late middle school, early high school, yeah, it does briefly touch on masturbation. And yes, there are racial slurs used in this book. You were a student once. You were a kid once. I was a kid once. I have kids. This is nothing that these kids aren't hearing about and seeing anyways. So why wouldn't we use to our advantage the experiences within these books to help them understand cultural nuance and to help them understand challenges potentially of their peers or of people they might not have exposure to because they live in certain communities where maybe they don't have Indigenous children in the area? Just because it says something that makes a parent uncomfortable or a couple kids uncomfortable does not mean it should be removed from the purview of all children or all people.
Well, I don't think the book has much value if it doesn't at least bring up issues that someone might be uncomfortable with or challenge our way of thinking. I mean, the reason why I read is, you know, I happen to be a pretty strong Democrat, and for anybody who knows me knows that's the case, but I try to read broadly and try to read things like Charles Krauthammer and Senator Mike Lee. And while I sometimes laugh at some of the points that people like Senator Lee might make, I feel it's really important to try to understand what they're saying. I do think if more of us did that, we'd probably be able to solve problems a little bit better, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And, you know, this book has been being attempted to or successfully banned since 2009. So if you think about how long this book has been upsetting people, I know you and I have a similar stance. I think that's great. That means it's making an impact, and it's been making an impact since at least 2009, right? Hey, I don't think it should be banned. I don't think it should be challenged. I think people need to get out of their comfort zone. I will caveat that. I know you mentioned Moms for Liberty. They actually only rated this a 2 on their rating scale of 1 to 5. So this is not something they would theoretically actively pursue in banning.
Well, they make up for it by trying to ban hundreds and hundreds of others.
Sure do.
And recently you probably saw we had a little back and forth with them on my Facebook page. We did.
I declined to engage in that conversation because I don't believe in feeding the trolls. Let them put their thoughts out there. They make themselves look silly. We can see by record going through Board of Ed meetings, through other public meetings and hearings, that people will show up and try to challenge and ban these books under their name. So don't try and say they're not. That's silly. But I did want to clarify, just because I, in the essence of truth and honesty, as I fully feel, they would probably not pursue banning this, but that doesn't mean other people won't. The community of people who find fault with literature is massive. And I think it just makes what we're doing so much more important to highlight that this is nonsense. Like, don't limit people's exposure because it makes you uncomfortable. You are but a party of one.
So, as a mom, what age would you recommend children read this? Or
I mean, first? Late middle school, definitely high school, but late middle school, it honestly may prepare them for some of the things that they'll face in high school.
And that's what we hope this show does, right, Vic? Yeah. Every Sunday, we hope the show prepares people for the week to understand issues a little better. I want to thank you, Vic, for being here today. Let's make sure that we keep shining a light on why people are trying to stop us from reading things. And thank you all for joining my guest, Chris Rosario. Shout out to Brett Brosner. We're sorry there was a glitch with the phone. You were supposed to be on giving us your Man from Washington report. We'll get you next week. Thank you all.